You're listening to Money Never Sleeps Radio. In your face.
What we got here is a failure to communicate.
Oh, have I got your attention now?
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
You know what I mean?
Money to be made in a place like this.
Money never sleeps, pal.
You're crazy. Don't run when you lose. Don't whine when it hurts.
You know what it takes to sell real estate?
It takes brass.
I'm falling, and I can't get up.
All right, welcome to Money Never Sleeps. This is a show where we talk about anything and everything that impacts the flow of money from around the corner to around the world. And I want to thank you for joining us today. The topic today is going to be junk bonds and digital credit note tokens. And the reason being, and I wanted to go over this on the show, because I do write white papers and give overviews and basically share my thoughts with the world. And I wrote a white paper in June of last year, and it focused on the rise of junk bonds and how this correlated to digital credit note tokens, perpetual and fixed-term DCNs, digital credit note tokens and DCNs, and I'll refer to that on the show as a DCN to avoid saying the whole name, but you have perpetual and fixed-term DCNs. And I wanted to go over the white paper in a little bit, and show how extremely relevant this is, especially today in this economic environment where blockchain technology and tokenization, it's taking center stage. You can see it, but on the news, anything for any major brokerage firm, financial institution, anywhere in the world, governments, it's taking center stage in financial market infrastructure, period, the end. But first, before I go into DCNs, first we need to go over what junk bonds are in general. A lot of people, they've heard them. Some understand them, some don't. I don't know. But I'm going to go over it anyway. Junk bonds, which are known as high yield bonds. And they're basically fixed income securities. They're issued by companies that have lower credit ratings traditionally. Now, this was the case because banks designated these issuers to carry greater default risk, meaning that, hey, there's a good chance you're going to lose all your money. And that's what they were worried about and they were putting out there. So they kind of shunned those companies for the longest time. The bonds, the junk bonds, they offer a higher interest rate to attract investors. This is the whole premise of that. This was the key basis for their utility and their growth in the 1980s especially. Now, these bonds typically fall below investment grade. And this was and still is determined by agencies like Moody's, S&P. So basically a Ba1 or a BB plus, double B plus, or lower would be the designation. Anything that or lower are considered junk bonds, junk status. And they became a transformative tool that was overlooked for a long time. It was there, but it was overlooked. And it sparked financing corporate growth, leveraged buyouts, and more, especially at the height of the junk bond utility in the 1980s. Now, anyone on Wall Street, anyone in finance, anyone out there that understands the world of finance, they know who Michael Milken is. Today, in his own right, even though no matter what he went through, in his own right, he is still a juggernaut in finance with the Milken Institute and whatnot. But now it's combined with his philanthropy. So he's doing a lot of good things out there. He's a smart guy, has always been. He just got tangled up in something back then, that kind of threw him for a whirlwind. But the reality is, if that did not happen, it's scary to think of the heights that he would have been. And he's high on the food chain now. Just imagine if things didn't happen. Anyway. He's famously known as the junk bond king. And undoubtedly, he was a transformative figure on Wall Street during his time at Drexel Burnham. That was in the late 70s and 80s. You know, started in New York and went to California, went to Beverly Hills. He did what others overlooked, and he fundamentally reshaped capital markets by challenging the norm that was happening in banking at the time. He said, you know what, this is what you're doing, this is how you're funding companies. I have a way, because I found out that, hey, you're ignoring this entire segment of the market because you're in your office eating your breakfast sandwich, you're eating your steak, and you're ignoring what is in front of you. So he did something about it. He didn't just say it, he did something about it. You know, and that's where there were long held assumptions about creditworthiness and investment risk and the like. It held a lot of companies from thriving due to the lack of access to growth capital. And that's the whole thing. You have a growth company, you need capital to grow. Without access, you're pretty much hitting a brick wall. And prior to Milken, companies with lower credit ratings, honestly, they were largely overlooked by traditional banks and institutional investors. And he saw an untapped opportunity and worked feverishly to seize it. He worked day and night. I'm going to tell you, his work ethic is ridiculous. But he worked day and night to get that done. His thinking, which was simple, that these so-called non-investment grade companies, they were unjustly marginalized, not because they were fundamentally flawed, because you had good companies, they just didn't have the history. So that history is what basically makes you credit worthy or not. And he saw a problem. He had a problem with that. And he saw it, and he said, this is a gap, this is an opening. All right, but because of outdated credit assessment models, this was the norm. So by properly structuring debt offerings and pricing the risk accordingly, what he did was successfully demonstrate that these companies could access capital markets efficiently. If done the right way, efficiently they can do it. And he didn't just say it, he proved it. He knew that if he accomplished that part, that the firm that he was with Drexel Burnham, they could fund growth, which would create jobs and increase revenue for the companies. They could apply this methodology to strategic acquisitions and innovation while offering investors significantly higher returns for their risk exposure. That's a fact. So what this did was open the doors to a new era of financing that extended capital to a broader array of businesses. And through his evolution of junk bonds, it redefined, no question, redefined how risk was understood across financial markets on a global scale. It was the spark that defined the golden era of the 1980s on Wall Street. Okay, if you look at, you know, Wall Street the movie, you know, 1987, you see that movie, you'll get an idea. And actually, if you look at footage from back then, it's ridiculous. But that was the heyday of Wall Street. You had Reagan in office, things were happening, and you had regulations that Joe Kennedy, he was the head of the SEC way back when. He was also a bootlegger, so that's interesting. Anyway, he put things in place because he did some shady things during his time with Hertz and whatnot, and he put some things in play that prevented companies from doing a lot of things, prevented banks from doing things, prevented brokerage firms from doing things. Basically, there were shackles on everyone. So President Reagan lifted all of that. Okay, and I guess one of the most significant innovations spearheaded by Michael Milken and his whole team was the creation of a robust secondary market for non-investment grade bonds, aka junk bonds. And you need a secondary market. You need to do that. You know, creating financial products isn't enough. You can create it and it looks good, everything, but there has to be a market for it. You have to create that market. And this is where that genius that he brought forward took flight. Before Milken implemented this, his master plan, that actually changed financial markets, not for a second, but forever. Those type of bonds were often illiquid, carried a stigma due to the name, and then limited appeal among investors. You know, investors are like, oh, junk bonds, oh, that's not for me. You know, you tell somebody, oh, I have a junk bond, they think, oh, you bought garbage. And that was the stigma. Okay, that was the stigma. So, you know, his mission, you know, was, again, pretty simple that I look at. Not, and I'm not saying it was easy by any means, because in order to do this, you have to be one committed soul. And he was. Okay, he was a ravenous wolverine when it came to this, but by no means easy. But it was simple thinking. So by cultivating institutional demand and increasing transparency around pricing and risk, he helped transform junk bonds into a legitimate and dynamic segment of the fixed income market. And it did, it opened up a lot of avenues. And it opened up avenues to a wider investor base and allowed companies with lower credit ratings to raise capital more freely. Again, it changed the playing field. Now, junk bonds, they did something that no one expected. Well, except for Michael Milken himself, right? That was it. Junk bonds becoming a powerful tool in leveraged buyouts and hostile takeovers. It enabled private equity firms, a.k.a. bootstrap firms that, you know, Henry Kravis and George Roberts, basically they, you know, and the whole KKR, they created the industry pretty much, right? Kohlberg as well. But they called it, you know, bootstrap, you know, firms. But it allowed them to finance acquisitions with minimal equity capital. Go figure. Do a deal, and you don't have to use a lot of your own money to do it. It was ingenious. And these bonds offered a way to secure large amounts of funding quickly. Now, this had a side effect. As often happens with any innovation in any industry, I don't care what it is, side effects do happen, right? And you can't avoid it. It fueled aggressive M&A strategies that reshaped entire industries. Basically, you know, you had companies that were in bidding wars and doing this stuff and driving up the price of these deals and the debt piling on and on. And bear in mind, when you're doing a leveraged buyout and you have debt attached to it, the company is responsible for that debt. So the bigger it is, the more the company has to pay. And the company doesn't have the revenue, doesn't have the income to do it, then they're going to be in default, and then that creates a whole different story altogether. But the fueling, the access to capital started to open up so big that if a deal, let's say, typically would be maybe $100 million, all of a sudden it's a $300 million deal. If it was $1 billion, it was automatically, whatever, $2-3 billion, whatever it was. But Milken's work played a central role in democratizing corporate control by allowing entrepreneurial acquirers to challenge established incumbents. Basically, they were able to go in because they had the backing. And it gave the likes of KKR the ability to increase the dollar value. As I said, they were able to go and raise more and more money for these deals, and it changed the game during the heyday of Wall Street. Good, bad, or indifferent, you can say what you want to say about it, have your opinion about it, but this is what changed the game in general to this day. Wall Street is not what it was in the 60s, was not what it was in the 70s. Wall Street, I mean, it changed forever, and is continuing to evolve. Blockchain itself is going to change everything. Watch, okay? But perhaps the most consequential impact that banks disliked a lot. They didn't like the innovation because it shifted the balance of power away from traditional banking to capital markets. Basically, from banks to investment banks. banks to brokerages, because you had access to various capital. This put capital raising right in the hands of investment banks and brokerage firms, such as, you know, it gave the rise to Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, First Boston, and a whole bunch of, you know, Lehman Brothers and the like, a whole bunch of prominent banks. For the first time ever, they were able to do this stuff. Now, this is because companies, they no longer needed to rely solely on banks for this financing, for large-scale financing. They finally had an option. And in life, if you have an option, that's a good thing. That is a good thing because you have another path to go and you're not trapped. Before, companies were trapped. Trust me, you had people going, you know, companies going from bank to bank to bank. And once one bank said no, the other's going to say no. And they probably laughed at them when they left. No more. That has ended. They were able now to tap into market-driven debt instruments, opening up new pathways for strategic growth and disrupting the established order of corporate finance. And again, not for that period, but forever, ever, and ever, and ever, and ever. Now, there are some landmark LBO deals during that time that without junk bonds and how Milken set the stage, these deals never would have happened. We would never know them. Basically, these three deals here changed a lot in finance. Changed a lot. Okay. KKR. They did a leveraged buyout of RJR and Nabisco. Just look at watch the movie, and I implore you to watch the movie Barbarians at the Gate, and you see what happened. You know, this was in 1988. This is a $25 billion deal in 1988. It was a pivotal deal that relied heavily in high-yield data on junk bonds. It relied on it pretty much 100% across the board. Now, Ted Turner's acquisition of MGM, you know, in 1985, well, that was funded by junk bonds. And what did he do? He built a media juggernaut. Revlon and Safeway LBOs to others. Then they enabled acquisitions and restructurings that would have never taken place otherwise. There may not be a Revlon today. Think about it. There were companies that would have, you know, hit a brick wall, would have been out today if it wasn't for junk bonds. The legacy of junk bonds, they laid the foundation for the modern structure of credit markets, right? What this did, it gave the rise to what we know during this era, what happened in the 2000s with the 2008 collapse and everything else, okay, where you have, you know, collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, and then you have MBOs and all that other stuff. But they're high yield. You have high yield exchange traded funds, ETFs. The junk bonds were, I guess, the grandfather to opening up all this stuff. And you see it now. You see all these structured products. And to me, I think it's a beautiful thing, innovation in finance. And as you can see, it really did change everything across all markets. Where CLOs emerge as a way to pool. Now, with CLOs, you're able to pool and tranche corporate loans, and they were often, you know, segregated below investment grade and securities, and they put it together and they created pretty much a new type of security. This allowed institutional investors to gain exposure to high yield credit while managing risk through credit enhancement and subordination. At the time, high yield ETFs, they brought accessibility and liquidity to the junk bond market, right, for retail institutional investors. This basically turned what was once an illiquid, opaque market into a dynamic and widely traded asset class. You see it now. The evolution is continuing. And now enters digital credit note tokens, DCNs. They can be perpetual or fixed term, just like any type of traditional bond. They indeed do represent the next evolution in this continuum. The distinct difference is this. where junk bonds and CLOs relied on centralized institutions and intermediary markets, DCNs leveraged blockchain technology to bring transparency, programmability, automation, and decentralization to debt instruments. This promoted global inclusion and democratized debt, something that an investor would always need to pay a stockbroker to do, a discount broker, whatever. You know, they had to go this route in order to acquire this stuff. But with DCNs, they can do stuff. You can be in the middle of a forest or the middle of a jungle, and if you have an internet connection and you have, you know, access, you can actually acquire it. You know, again, it changes the game. DCNs, they're built on decentralized infrastructure, and in this case, the Pico Novus blockchain. And they're launched through groups such as XMG FinTech. DCNs, they combine the utility of smart contracts, the yield-generating mechanics of high-yield debt, but with automatic hourly distribution of this yield, and the liquidity potential of cryptocurrency markets. This is what changes the game. It's an innovative product. What makes this further interesting is that each DCN carries high fidelity data within smart contract with full transparency. This allows DCNs to be as compliant as they need to be. They can be customized to fit the needs of any specific issuance, and the best part is that you have the global accessibility solution for capital formation, risk transfer, and investment. This is bridging traditional finance with the innovations of decentralized finance, the convergence of TradFi and DeFi, period, the end. There's no question that digital credit note tokens are innovative at its core. Being blockchain-based debt instruments, allowing for the development of greater structure, transparency, and programmability in both the private and institutional credit markets, they do represent a new category of financial tools that are purpose-built to meet the demands of a rapidly evolving financial ecosystem, one that is increasingly merging traditional finance with decentralized finance. Now, there is always an innovator behind innovative financial instruments, as we saw with Michael Milken. And in this case, DCNs, they were pioneered and launched by FJA Partners. This was done by leveraging the advanced infrastructure of the Pico Novus blockchain and deploying the DCNs via XMG FinTech. Now, these aren't just tokens that were created out of thin air. They have digital asset treasuries that collateralize each DCN. And that is the changeup. This brings more comfort to a debt offering. So it's beyond the junk bond, right? You know, so it brings more comfort by it being backed by more than the word of a company. It's backed by a digital asset treasury. Now, a digital asset treasury, at the very least, should include the native token of the blockchain is built in. So, for instance, if Pico Novus, then Pico Coins. If Ethereum, then ETH. If Solana, then, you know, SOL. You know, so it needs to have that in there. There's no question. And, you know, they can also include tokenized operations, tokenized real-world assets in the treasury, you know, as well as other native tokens of layer one blockchains, you know, like a Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the like. DCNs represent the next evolution of structured credit and structured debt instruments. Let me just correct that, debt instruments. Offering a unique combination of protection, transparency, and programmability risk. And I mentioned this before. All these things are important. They were introduced on the Pico Novus blockchain for a reason, and I have to go over that reason so it's understood. This was due to the ability to structure the DCNs in a way and innovate them and let them evolve in a way that would be cost-effective, scalable, portable, and could be bridged across other blockchains in the future. They are blockchain-based instruments, and they were designed to modernize and streamline the credit landscape by embedding smart contract functionality for automated yield distributions. Callable features, real-time transparent auditing, and treasury collateralization. Now, achieving all this without the cumbersome layers of traditional financial infrastructure, without all the nonsense, without all the stuff in the middle. All right, you're talking about technology. You're talking about a financial instrument, a tool that can help you to achieve things in a transparent manner that any regulatory body would plainly see that, hey, this is what's going on. This is everything that's there that they have access to, looking at everything. And transparency is everything. Transparency is everything. DCNs initially being created on the Piku Novus blockchain, again, that was strategic. As a blockchain, which was launched in 2017, I don't think a lot of people know this, was launched in 2017, so almost a decade ago. It was never a hype machine, nor it wasn't built as Ethereum was built. It wasn't built as other blockchains were built. It wasn't built to go hype and get people to go do this and do that, and there was no ICO. There was none of that stuff going on. There was a basic thought process to create a blockchain that can be utilized for institutional grade financial instruments to be built on. This is what it was built for, and it allowed for a lot of different things to happen. Okay, now the PNP16 protocol, it allows for speed, scalability, and that was a great thing. But in April of 2026, after consensus, the ERC20 EVM compliance was integrated into the protocol of the blockchain, and that was a big change up. And it was a positive move because it does allow for broader reach across the decentralized ecosystems that are out there. Okay, so when I hear from people that, why are DCNs built on Piku Novus? Why, Piku Novus isn't as well known as other blockchains, or they're not retail focused, there was no ICO, there's not hype behind it, there's all this stuff that's not going around. And basically, or that it hasn't been widely traded on centralized exchanges, I say to them that this is the reason why DCNs and other financial products were created on Piku Novus, for this reason. Get rid of the noise, create the utility. It gave the time to cultivate and enhance DCNs. Without that time, things could have went a different way. If it was created on a blockchain that was heavily retail focused and you had all this stuff going on, it never would have had the opportunity to trip and fall and build back up and create what's here today. It gave the time to cultivate and enhance DCNs, and that's why. There's no question that Piku Novus itself is going to find itself on various centralized crypto exchanges across various crypto analytic aggregators soon enough. But in the end, the value of any blockchain is its utility, not the hype, not all the social media posts, all this other stuff. It's ridiculous, right? The utility. Ethereum has extreme utility. They have a lot of big retail, out there, and they've been around for a long time, and they've been pushing this initiative for a long time. Bitcoin, is a grandfather, but it doesn't have that utility. It doesn't mean that it's not valued. Of course it's valued. It's like digital gold. However, the utility to go and do something with it other than what it's in front of you is not there. Avalanche has extreme utility. Piku Novus has extreme utility. Solana has extreme utility, right? Depending on what the utility is going to be. In this era of crypto, it is the utility, not the hype, that wins the game. The utility. In closing, just remember this, that what sets DCNs apart is their ability to deliver the benefits of traditional finance such as enforceable obligations, yield generation, and credit structuring. All of this without the inefficiencies that often come with doing it on a TradFi path. They eliminate unnecessary gatekeeping, create an automated yield distribution structure, reduces reliance on opaque intermediaries, and it promotes accessibility across a global decentralized marketplace, giving way to a greater centralized marketplace. A lot of things are happening, people. The future of blockchain, you know, and its promise is coming. And the future's here. Remember, it isn't about the hype. It's all about the utility when it comes to blockchain. Anyway, I want to thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening to the show. I hope that this gave you some insight into digital credit note tokens, the junk bond history, what's happening, and the various blockchains that are out there. All right. Anyway, I want to wish all you hardworking people throughout the United States and globally, for that matter, a happy Labor Day, and we will be back with you next week on Money Never Sleeps.
Initiating shutdown sequence.
You're listening to UCW Radio in your face.
What is your major malfunction?
So let it be written. So let it be done.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on Money Never Sleeps Radio are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial advice. The host, Louis Velazquez, and guests of Money Never Sleeps Radio are not licensed financial advisors, and any investment decisions made based on information presented in this podcast are at the listener's own risk. Listeners are encouraged to consult with a qualified financial advisor or investment professional before making any investment decisions. The podcast hosts and guests do not endorse or recommend any specific investment strategies or products. All investments involve risk, and past performance is not indicative of future results.